The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
A warning from Saudi Arabia's energy minister appeared aimed at U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday. His remarks come after the Biden administration recently announced plans to sell an additional 15 million barrels from America's strategic petroleum reserve by year's end as it tries to curb high gasoline prices in the wake of production cuts from OPEC.
People are depleting their emergency stocks.
Yes.
Had depleted it, used it as a mechanism to manipulate markets, while its profound purpose was to mitigate shortages of supply.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
I don't know if you made all that out, but that was Saudi Arabia's energy minister, and he accused countries of using their emergency oil reserves to manipulate prices rather than helping with shortages of supply. Good afternoon. It's good to be here with you today. I'm Drew Mariani, and I'm grateful to spend the next couple hours with you. We got a lot to take a look at. I don't know if you filled your car up recently. Gas prices have consistently been mentioned by a lot of voters right now as one of the main issues in the midterm elections. The president is kind of playing up the fact that, hey, prices are down, but they're still way significantly higher than when he first took office. And, of course, he's been using our strategic oil reserves to help offset some of those costs, which I do think is problematic. I'd heard from somebody, we don't have that much, about 25 days worth of diesel left in this country. So I don't know about you, and I'm not here just to beat on the president. I just want truth. I want to bring you truth. I want to look at the. I want a bright future. I want a better country. Right, that's what I want. Believe in the greatness of this country and of its people. When the president tries to gaslight you, right, into believing that gas was always cost $7 a gallon in California, I don't think most people believe him. You know, one of the tactics to lower prices is drawing down the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And right now, according to a former employee of the SPR, he goes under a pen name. He's using the name William Duncan at the American Thinker. Our reserves, just to give you a perspective of where we are right now, thanks to the distribution of these things, our reserves are now just over half of their capacity. Half their capacity. When the Biden administration began, they had been almost full. Okay, so you go from an almost full reserve down to about half. The cost to refill them at current prices, if we were to try to refuel our strategic reserve, be between $26 and $27 billion. And it's going to take a long time to fill them just because of the logistics that are involved in that. So the administration right now is playing around with petroleum. They're not allowing for domestic production. And that's brought us to the point where we now have less than a month's supply of diesel. 25 days. 25 days. Winter's coming. It's going to be cold. Here's the thing. To me, it's just so frustrating. This is just incredibly frustrating. And it's all of these things are built on policy. I was watching different news outlets this morning, and I'm thinking, when you go to vote in a couple of days for the midterms, please go out. Make sure you know who you're voting for and why and what they will represent and how they will either bring the country into a healthier position or they'll continue going down this path of bad policy. It has been bad policy that has led us to this point. You take a look at defunding the police and getting rid of bail, right? What happens? We see crime spiking. You tap into our strategic, petroleum reserves. You ban drilling, right? You put the hammer down. And Joe Biden, he promised when he was running, big oil was going to be in trouble. And we've seen what has happened. And as a result of this, your gas prices, your fuel prices, cost of heating your home is skyrocketing. And it's not going to end. It's going to get worse as winter comes. So, all this gaslighting about how great this is, all this environmental stuff, I'm all about being a good steward of the environment, no doubt about it. I think we have to be. But we got to be judicious about how we get to that point. I'm still fighting off a cold, so excuse me if every once in a while there's a silence. That means I'm coughing. The low supply right now, and just final thought on this, and I'll move off it. It's also been hit, of course, by the ban on Russian oil. right? The Putin's war, as Joe Biden likes to put it. I mean, that war in Ukraine certainly is having an effect here as well. Also, seasonal maintenance of refiners. A lot of factors that go into this. But the oil that's used to make diesel, it's also used for home heating oil. So if you're to run out of diesel, let's say in 25 days, that would spell disaster for our economy. The trucks run on diesel. You see how high diesel prices are. I mean, we talk about delivery cost, right? Supply chain. We've got Christmas coming. How many people now are so accustomed to ordering online? They're waiting for their packages to arrive at the door rather than go to the malls or the stores. So we're going to see a great demand for shipping and for diesel. Our store supplies, they're supplied by trucks and trains, both which use oil. But I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to figure out what would happen if we ran out. So let's just hope those in charge, and I'm sure they're working on it, can take whatever actions needed to take care of the particular situation. So we'll see how it all ultimately shakes out. Another issue, China. So let's talk about them for just a quick second here. You might remember hearing about China when, they were establishing these police stations in different countries around the world in order to check up on their citizens who are in those regions. And I shared a story with you of how they are actually doing that here in our own country. There are two of these stations in Toronto. One is actually, believe it or not, New York City. So the BBC was reporting that the Dutch media have now found another one of those Chinese stations that monitor and track their civilians, those police stations, now in the Netherlands. And they spoke with a doctor who is now being harassed by Chinese authorities to return home because he's been speaking out against the Chinese government. And the Dutch foreign ministry said that they found out about it, though the media, excuse me again, I have been fighting a terrible cold, and I'm trying to get out of it here, but it's rough. I was sharing about the Dutch foreign ministry where they said they found out about this just through the media, not from China. So the Chinese, of course, are denying this. But I just want to put it on your radar. We see them buying up land in the U.S. We see this in New York City. I think China, in the days ahead, is going to be one of our greatest economic competitors, adversaries. And I am concerned about what we're going to see in terms of their military might and what they're trying to accomplish. San Francisco, one final story here. They're starting to face reality. Here's a follow-up for you, right? The Wall Street Journal was reporting that they commissioned a study on the effects of their ban on travel, and government contracts within 30 different states. Remember we talked about this? The ban is in place because the city of San Francisco didn't agree with the social values that certain states had. So they put a ban. You couldn't travel there, right? Can't go there. Nope. Like forbidding abortions or letting boys use girls' locker rooms. If you didn't agree with that, well, then the San Francisco Board of Supervisors says, nah, you can't go, right? The study found that ban, the only effect that it had, was costing the city tens of millions of dollars more a year. So just think about that. If you can't get a product from, let's say, South Dakota, let me put this a different way. Let's say you can get a product from South Dakota, North, whatever state it is, right? But you don't like the values, right? You don't like those values. So the only other place to get it is, say, it's Massachusetts. Well, that's a lot farther across the country, right? It's twice as far. It's going to cost you a lot more to get it, right? And it's ended up costing the state money. It's just foolish policy. It's just so, it's all virtue signaling. It's all pushed by an ideological agenda. The leaders of the city, in San Francisco now are, they're beginning to figure this out. And I guess they got to swallow kind of a bitter pill as a result of it. Prayers for one of our former colleagues here. I know you know Dave Durand. He's a frequent guest on Morning Air. I've been following the story. I don't know how plugged in you are. I mean, there was that tragedy that happened. Remember in Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, there's a guy named Darryl Brooks. And he just took his SUV. Remember that? And he just plowed through all these people at that Christmas parade. It was horrible. A little 8-year-old boy died. A lot of women and other people died there. Dave Durand's wife was actually killed in that horrible, horrible act. They called it an act of terrorism. 76 charges have now he's been found guilty of. And, he actually fired his attorney earlier on in the trial and decided to represent himself. And when people do that, I just think there's something not right with them. You know, unless you've got your law degree, unless you have experience, you're playing with your life, right? So he decided to represent himself as a so-called sovereign citizen, and it obviously didn't work well for him. The jury took only, I think it was a few hours to reach a verdict, and as I said, one of those killed was a beautiful lady named Tamara Duran, the wife of a frequent radio guest here, Dave Duran, and I'd ask you to pray for him. I saw her on screen today, and I was like, oh, man, it just breaks my heart. Because these things you never think hit home. That one hit pretty close to home as well, at least for relevant radio listeners and those here as well. Hey, I don't know if you've been following at all or you have seen these wackos, and that's what I'm calling them. I know it probably sounds uncharitable, but that's exactly what I think this is. When I see people destroying artwork in the name of climate, I mean, it's wacky. I mean, it is wacky, wacky stuff. I don't know if you've caught any of this over in Europe. We've been hearing about incidences where, these climate change activists are going to go to this art gallery, right? This classic pieces of art. And then they throw something on it, right? And then what they do is take out the super glue and they glue their hands to the wall or to the frame or something. And they start shouting about the climate. And, I sit back and I'm like, well, what does classic art have to do with climate, right? The couple acts have happened. The latest acts have happened against, a very beautiful piece, Sunflowers, right, by Vincent van Gogh at the National Gallery in London. And then again, a classic Monet piece, Claude Monet, Haystacks at the New Museum Barberini in Germany. But they dumped tomato sauce on the Van Gogh, and they threw, I think, mashed potatoes against the Monet. Unfortunately, the Van Gogh was protected by a shield, and I had heard that the Monet wasn't so lucky. It's going to need a little bit of restoration work. But let me bring you up to speed on the story. You might not have heard about this. The audio from the latest act of vandalism by these climate activists who've been super gluing themselves to these famous paintings. Listen to this. Today's act was towards the girl with the pearl earring. This is another one that just took place. It's a very famous painting by Vermeer. Listen to this account.
How do you feel when you see something beautiful and priceless being apparently destroyed before your eyes? Do you feel outraged? Where is that feeling when you see the planet being destroyed before our very eyes?
Yeah, before your very eyes. As I hear them go ahead and make those claims. How do you feel when you see something beautiful being destroyed? Well, I feel terrible. I don't want to see the planet destroyed. I certainly don't want to see a Vermeer or a Van Gogh or a Monet or any other classic piece of work destroyed. How are you different from somebody who's polluting the environment if you're destroying something beautiful by throwing mashed potatoes or soup all over it? How are you any different? How's your example different? It's like me saying, hey, murder is wrong, and then I go and murder somebody to show you the point. How do you feel about me murdering this person? It's ridiculous. It's stupid logic. I don't know. I'd love to hear how you feel, too. You can always join me, 888-914-9149. The tweet they sent out over some of these videos of their stunt read this. Let me just read this. This is the one about the Monet. And here's what they said. He says, we make this Monet the stage and the public audience. It takes a painting with mashed potatoes or tomato soup thrown at it to make society remember that fossil fuel recourse is killing us all. Then we'll give you a mashed potato on a painting, end of quote. I mean, the tweet doesn't even make a whole lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, but that's their logic. These are juvenile tactics. That's what they are, juvenile tactics. They are not going to do anything to change the environment. They're certainly not going to change people's minds. And they're no different than somebody who destroys something beautiful, right? They're in the same camp as the very people that they're screaming about. A lot of people are wondering how these childish people even got past security in the museum. That's a good question. How do you get in with mashed potatoes and a can of soup, right? They've also had suggestions like closing off the gallery or leaving them glued to the wall for a few hours without food or water or toilets. I don't think that's right. Hey, I'm joined today by a longtime friend of this radio program. It's been a while since I've spoken to her, but she's internationally recognized as an art historian. As I saw the one story and the second story and the third story, I began to follow more of these stories. I said, I really got to get her back on. Her name's Elizabeth Lev. She's the co-author of the book, of a book commissioned by the Vatican Museum called A Body for Glory. It's the theology of the body in the art of Michelangelo. It's well worth having. And you can, of course, learn more about her, her great work. Elizabeth-Lev.com is her website. Elizabeth, welcome back. Good to talk with you again.
It is great to talk to you, too. How are you?
I am well. I am doing pretty well hanging out. A little bit under the weather. I've been battling a chest cold and everything else. But beyond that, I'm well. What's your take on this story? As an art historian, this is just wacky stuff. Gluing your hand to the frame. At least they haven't taken a knife to it or a hammer to these images. I mean, they're throwing mashed potatoes or soup. But still, give me your take on the logic. This so often you hear there was an attack on a Vermeer, and the person says, "How do you feel when something beautiful is destroyed?" And my point is, well, I feel terrible. I don't want to see the environment destroyed. I don't want to see a painting destroyed. The logic here seems to be disconnected, but give me a sense on what's happening. I pointed out three cases. You might be aware of more. How often is this happening in Europe, and how effective is it?
Well, we, of course, had the case in the Vatican Museums of the Laocoon that was, it had the big sign put in front of it, and they glued themselves to the Laocoon. And fortunately, I was on vacation that week. That is, I'm very puzzled, as are you, I think, how these people are getting past security, because I do happen to know that the Laocoon is so deeply alarmed that if you reach too far over the rope, yep, all the alarms go off and custodians come out of nowhere. And just for pointing over the, I remember a person just pointing over the arm and being taken off into a room to be talked to for quite some time. So how do I feel about this? I mean, as an art historian, as a human being, as someone who loves beauty, I think this is a very irresponsible way to try to get attention. To me, this looks like a giant temper tantrum where I'm just going to throw, literally, this is what children do, isn't it? They throw mashed potatoes. They throw their food on the floor. They throw their food at their parents in order to get what they want. But how does that make your cause more sympathetic? How does that make me more interested in what you have to say when your gesture is destruction, when you respond to what you claim to be destruction of the planet by more destruction?
Exactly.
How on earth, what are you offering?
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you. I remember there was a time when the Pietà, that classic work by Michelangelo, was just roped off. I mean, there was, you know, and it was sitting there right there inside the Vatican until a madman comes up with a hammer and takes it to the face of the Virgin Mary and takes her nose off. And I think breaks her hand too. That was repaired. Now it's behind glass. You can't even get to it. And maybe there was mental illness there. I don't see the mental illness here. I see them trying to use art and maybe the possible destruction of it to make a point. This started earlier in the year, and correct me if I'm wrong. I believe in London. You can correct me if it was earlier than that. But there's been multiple accounts. Are gallery owners doing something now to try to stop this, or is there greater security going to take place? I mean, what is happening? What's going on in these museums around the world?
Well, as far as I can see from my end, where we are surrounded by works of art that are extraordinary, I have not seen any increased surveillance. I was in the Uffizi this weekend. A Botticelli painting was also a victim of this, one of these little episodes or escapades. The Laocoon remains, as usual, in its usual alarmed state, although I still wonder what happened to the alarm on the day that the climate protesters came. So, I'm not seeing a... But which, on the other hand, I mean, as you already cited, the Pietà, once the attack happened, then the Pietà was closed off behind glass, and no one will ever get close to it again. So, yeah, in many ways, I'm thankful that that museums have not responded by creating even greater and deeper barriers to prevent us from getting closer and closer to a work of art, because it would be terrible shame if we had to stand at a further distance and be even further removed from beauty because of the ugliness of the behavior of people who don't know how to make their cause or make their arguments in a way that is not destructive or ruinous, really.
Yeah. I just think of the tremendous beauty just in Italy alone. You can go the David in Florence, right? That's not behind glass. And I kind of wonder, should some of these classic arts do that at the Uffizi? Correct me on the title. I believe, is it The Rape of Daphne? I mean, such a magnificent sculpture. These are out. You can practically touch them. Should these incredible masterpieces be protected in the event somebody's trying to make a point over the environment, or maybe they're just not right mentally, just for the sake of protection?
I understand your point. Apollo and Daphne, which is in the Galleria Borghese here in Rome, is a work that you can approach and you can around. It's meant to be walked around. Yep. It's in the room where it was originally placed, and it's an incredible experience to be able to see that work of art in the place where it was originally put. It would truly be a loss if these people who are acting out their concerns for a future without thinking about a future for beauty were able to distance us and create even a greater divide between us and that which is beautiful or a work of art. So it would end up being like the situation with the Mona Lisa, where everybody goes to take a picture, but nobody actually ever looks at it.
Right.
And
you
know, what use is beauty if no one can look at it or experience it, or you know, every time you get too close to it, there's someone yelling at you. I feel like this the real risk that we're running here with this, with these episodes, is that what if there is this kind of a crackdown that would really create something that is lasting, is beauty. These works are 500 years old. Laocoon, it's 2,000 years old.
That's amazing.
Has managed to speak, persuade, and inspire people. So I'm confused about a movement that claims it's interested in saving the planet and doing something great, that wants to, that its means to do so is by demolishing, by ruining, by muffling that beauty that has actually been uplifting in times of difficulty.
Yeah, I say the same thing. I mean, what makes them different than somebody who's polluting a waterway, right? I mean, if you have a problem with them destroying, why don't you have a problem with yourself destroying something so beautiful? There's a tremendous disconnect there.
The thing that I find very confusing is that just a few weeks later, an upset man, a mentally disturbed man, knocked down two statues where he did minimal damage, but he did some damage, €15,000 worth of damage. But he did damage to two sculptures, which he knocked down because he was clearly disturbed and he wanted to see Pope Francis and he was refused. And this is the case that went around the world. And everybody's talking about it. Oh, the bad American tourist. Everyone immediately tried to find out the nationality so that they could say, oh, this was a bad American tourist. But when two climate change activists come in, break the rule of crossing over the line that you are, that protects the work of art, glue themselves to the work of art, put up a poster, throw mashed potatoes or whatever it is, nobody seems to care. I'm very confused about the double standard here.
No, I agree. And does this do anything at all to help their cause? Is it raising awareness? Is it making people more passionate about climate? I don't know. I don't know what you're hearing.
Oh, it is. It's making me quite passionate about climate change. If this is all you got,
true.
If this is what you have to tell me, then I'm afraid you're losing me every minute a little bit more. If your argument is that of destruction to talk about saving the planet, then you have lost me as your follower, advocate, or person that's listening to you. And I think they're losing people. I think most adults see this for what it is, which is a very, very childish way of getting attention.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, let me throw a question to you that they throw out when they do these acts, okay? The stunt crew asked this question, and it actually gave me a little bit of pause. I had to think about it. You know, what is worth more, they say, art or life? You know, and of course, I'm going to say life. However, I want your response to what's worth more? Not the question. Well, not the answer, but so much the question when they posit it that way.
I would start with the fact that the idea that one's life is in danger because of climate change. I'm still waiting to hear who has died of climate change. Mm-hmm. You can die of pollution. You can die of a lot of different things, but I've yet to hear of someone who died of climate change. So this argument, art life, is already a false argument to begin with. It's not real. Yep. But when it really comes down to it, between art and life, I mean, I would not trade another person's life for a work of art. But if it were me, if it were me and the work of art, would I get between something and a great work of art? Perhaps I might, because I'm going to only be here for a little while. But yeah. These works, they've been here and they've brought so much joy and so much inspiration. Between me and the Pietà, well, maybe I might have done good for a couple people in my life. But what the Pietà has done for people over the 500 years it's been there, I'd be willing to invest. I'd seriously consider investing in the power of the Pietà over anything that Liz Leff can do. So, I mean, I do think we underestimate the importance of beauty. They think of it as art. They think of it as an object. We are talking about things that are beautiful, things that uplift, that inspire, that make life worth living for others. Yeah. Whereas their alternative, I'm not quite sure what they mean about life, because if their idea of life is a bunch of people who destroy and get angry when they don't get what they want, that's not much of a life now, is it?
Liz, two quick things. I only have about a minute or two left. I can't recall, but wasn't there a troupe that say the very famous piece of art or saved art from Hitler? Didn't Hitler have aspirations for it? You familiar with something along those lines?
You are right. You are thinking of the Monuments Men, and in particular, in the book, and particularly in the film, the focal point was Michelangelo's Madonna of Bruges, as well as the Ghent altarpiece. Those were the two pieces that were sort of the stars of the story, as Hitler was planning on first spiriting away works of art, and then, according to the book and the film, he intended to destroy them, and they were saved at the last minute. So yes, there are famous works of art that have been put in danger because of that's a problem with art. We have only only a few snippets of art because so many people have destroyed art because they were unhappy because they were losing.
It killed me when I saw ISIS blowing up ancient monuments and artwork and things along those lines. It's horrible. Hey, I've got to leave it right there. We'll have you back, but you had a big event coming up, don't you, in Chicago? When is that? You want to tell everyone about that very quickly?
I am. November 17, 18, 19, we're going to be bringing Dante to Chicago in art, music, and acting. It's called Dante 360 at the Chicago Athenaeum for Thought and Culture. And we are really, really, really excited about trying to revive someone who lived in difficult times, was worried about the end of the world, and responded with beauty and faith and art.
Well, maybe my wife and I will shoot down there, too. We'll get a chance to say hello. It'd be awesome. Liz, thank you. Thanks for all you're doing.
We'd love that.
God bless you, okay? Thanks. That's Liz Leff, and I hear the ad's running. You can check it out. It's the Athenaeum Center, I believe, .org, where you can get more information on that Dante event. I have to take a short pause. Stay with me. Our conversation continues when I return.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
Our sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
We begin, though, this morning with record-breaking turnout for early voting just 2 weeks ahead of the midterm elections.
More than 8 million people have already cast their ballots nationally, with several states surpassing early numbers seen during the 2020 presidential election. In key states like Georgia, voter turnout saw a 159% increase compared to early voting in the last midterm election 4 years ago. And for those who have not yet cast their ballots, well, perhaps they'll be swayed by debates taking place in key states, like the one last night in Florida, which saw some heated exchanges.
Current news through a Catholic lens. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, if you found the broadcast and you like it, well, turn somebody else on. It's a great way to evangelize. It's a great way to get them plugged in to what I really hope is a moral perspective on the most important issues of the day. And that's what I'm here to give you. And you can join me every afternoon, 2 to 5 Central, 3 to 6 Eastern, noon to 1 Pacific time, or anytime on our mobile app, okay? Go to our podcast, share them, get other people plugged in. It's great to be with you today. We're going to pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy coming up in about 25 minutes. One of the highlights of my day. And I could certainly use the prayers today. I'm still fighting what has been a... Look, my wife says to me, I never saw anybody with an immune system like yours. I tend to beat sicknesses pretty quickly, right? So I get back from this trip to Israel, Palestine, Middle East. We get back, and I must have picked something up. And, man, I just... It has gripped me, but I am in the final stages of it. So if you could just continue to remember me in your prayers during the chaplet for that, I'd appreciate that as well. Quick programming note here for you too, and this is important if you could do this because it's a blessing to you. I got an email from Relevant Radio the other day. I'm on their mailing list too because I support, and they said today I think the line was, "Who are your souls?" I'm like, "Who are your souls?" And then I realized, oh, yeah, we've got this Relevant Radio novena November 2nd through the 10th, right? And you can submit up to 20 names, 20 of your departed loved ones at relevantradio.com/souls, relevantradio.com/souls. And you can do it all the way up to the end of that novena, all the way up to November 10th. It's free. Yeah, it's the beauty of it. You don't have to pay for a mass. You don't have to do anything. And your loved ones, that son or daughter that passed away, that sibling, that parent, you know, whoever it may be, the friend that you promised prayers for, they'll be remembered every day in the Holy Mass. And there's nothing more powerful than the sacrifice of the Mass. I'll pray every day the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, and they'll be remembered at night in the Rosary. So, again, get your 20 names in. It's fast, it's simple, it's easy, it's free, relevantradio.com/souls. You can do it from today all the way up to the 10th. I haven't done it yet either, so don't feel bad if you haven't. I'm like you, oh, I got to do that, and then life gets in the way. So I'll be here to continue to remind you, all right, in the days ahead. Hey, coming up in a minute, I do want to talk a little bit about what's happening in these polls. And let's dive into this just for a quick second before we maybe pray a little bit later. We're seeing a lot of things unfold right now, right? I don't know where you are, what your politics are. I am seeing just a real shift in the country over a number of things. You know, I think the midterms, I think Republicans are going to predominantly win that. And I think, as I said in the beginning, it's tied to policy. Bad policy when it comes to energy. Bad policy when it comes to spending. We've overspent. We've overheated the economy. We've got inflation, you know, at a quarter of a century high. I mean, you see your food prices, right? We see what's happening with the indoctrination of our kids and this woke ideology that is so pervasive in our country. And you know what? The groups that the Democrats have often camped out on have been, you know, the Black and the Latino vote. They've been reliably Democratic for decades. There's some new polling out, and it shows there's a swing underway right now. And, you know, candidates are, I think part of the reason is Democrats have become more extreme than ever. I think people used to be more center. You know, you might be a little bit left, a little bit right. No longer, right? No way. I think things have become extreme. We live in a time of extremes. You know, in 2012, to give you a little perspective, Barack Obama, he won the Hispanic vote by 71%. That's wild, right? In 2020, Biden won it by 61%, right? 61%. So Trump cut the gap maybe 10%. I was surprised at that because Trump was all about walls and everything else. But no, there were people saying no, you know, 61% still, it's the majority. So now the edge has been cut, check this number out, by more than half. 50% now saying they plan to vote for Democrats this year. So it's been a slippery slope from 2012 to 2020 to this year. And I think in part because I think the Latino voting group is just tired of being taken for granted, right? You had all sorts of different things that were happening. They see this LGBT extremism attacking and destroying the meaning of family. We see many people frustrated with the attack on the role of parents, right? That we've got to get a constitutional amendment, right? That's where we are in this country. We're seeing a shift in attitudes when it comes to voting for support of police, for, you know, just economic sanity. I mean, are people going to be sane about spending and trying to get out of debt? Our border is porous. We've got fentanyl problems. You know, we got this attack on life. So, you know, the Latino vote, majority of that is Catholic. And a lot of these issues, life and family, it goes against everything that that they really believe. A lot of polls have shown that and the Democrats have really camped out for a while on abortion too, right? We know that, right? I'm sick of seeing pro-abortion ads. It's disgusting. It's nauseating. It's wrong is what it is. It's evil. It's probably the best word for it. There were several polls that showed Catholic Senator Patty Murray is in trouble with something like 51% of support against a pro-life candidate, Tiffany Smiley. So that's shocking. It's almost unbelievable. Washington is a deep blue state. Joe Biden won it by over 20% in 2020. And you see these races nationwide, you know, beginning to shrink, beginning to get tighter. I didn't get all of the Fetterman-Oz debate. I did watch it later, though, the next day, just to see what went down. And some pundits are calling it the worst debate performance in modern history. That's what they're saying. And my heart went out to Fetterman. I don't know how about you. You know, he suffered a major stroke, nearly incomprehensible throughout that debate. You know, many people question Joe Biden's mental faculties and his capabilities. And we're seeing the same thing with Fetterman. I think we need people who can take on the stress, the demand, right, of governing. You know, the daily duty that's required from a senator, from a congressperson, from the head of the executive branch of our government. Oz in Pennsylvania, which is a blue state, right, is now surging. Although a million people have already voted in Pennsylvania, so we'll see how that shakes out. I think that's going to be a close rate. But there are a lot of races for governors. They're moving closer to. Governor Ron DeSantis down in Florida is up big. People love him. They don't want him to run for president. I mean, they love him. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, I don't want them to take my governor, right? They don't want. I was on a trip with some people who were saying that from Florida. We just like the guy. We don't want to see him run for president. Yeah, he's got, I think, an 11-point lead in polls against Charlie Crist, who is a pro-death, pro-abortion candidate. In Kansas, there is a governor there by the name of Laura Kelly, who's tried to portray herself as a moderate. Not a bad strategy, right? But her image in Kansas is crumbling, as news broke, that her administration's funding a drag show for minor children. Right? Why would you do that? Right? Why would you do that? Kathy Hochul, again, she was never really elected. She's statistically tied. She's the liberal from New York, right? And polling shows that hardline abortion and LGBT, you know, she's been promoting that agenda. It's not winning her the vote she wants. You know, she's statistically tied with a guy named Lee Zeldin, who is pro-life, pro-family. Right, he's a congressman from Long Island. So I'm throwing this out there. We're going to talk about some of the swing states. We're going to take a look at some of these issues coming up. We all have to go out and vote soon. I haven't spent a whole lot of time on politics. I like to touch on it a little bit because I think it is a mechanism in our country that facilitates change. It is important. We are called. I think we have a moral duty and obligation to have a well-formed conscience and to participate in public life and civic life. It advances the common good. It protects the vulnerable, right? It creates policy and advances policy that helps those, perhaps, that aren't as fortunate as you. So I would encourage you, as the elections come up, whatever state you're in, whether it's New York or California, do your due diligence, all right? Evaluate the platforms. Evaluate the policies. Look at the history of these particular candidates, all right? And then vote accordingly. You may not think that much hangs in the balance. It does for the country. I think it does for your soul as well. I think one day when we stand before God, we are going to have to stand accountable for how we have voted. And I think that's a pretty big, big responsibility. So look, I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, let's talk about it. There's a lot to get into with you today. A lot going on. Early voting, swing states. We've got a lot hanging in the balance. So if you want to get in, feel free to join me. The number's 888-914-9149. The chaplet is 15 minutes away, and boy, we got a great show ahead, too. We're going to take a look at cohabitating in older age. A lot of people are doing that. We'll take a look at depression. We'll look at ghosts or haunted homes and more.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forrester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, live, coming up. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, it's good to be with you today. Thanks for joining me. Closing in on midterm elections, my producer Maggie yesterday, while I was praying the rosary with Father Rocky on the air, says, hey, I'm at... Maggie, open your mic quickly. Let's talk about that very quickly, and we'll go to our next guest. Were you at a debate? You were at a debate in Illinois? What was going down? Because you said to me it was kind of shameful what you saw.
Oh, my gosh, Drew. I went to a local debate in Des Plaines, Illinois. And I have to say I was shocked because not a single candidate stood for life.
Wow.
And, you know, they asked about a woman's right to choose was one of the first questions. And the question was framed in a way where they said, you know, how will you fight for a woman's right to choose? So that's how it was presented. And then the second question was a question from the audience that the man that was putting on the debate had selected. And he said, the second question is, how will you fight for LGBTQ rights in our community? And I was just like, you guys, the house is on fire. There's five major issues that I could list off on the top of my head that we really need to tackle. And so that true. You live in the United States and you live in Illinois. Are you really repressed? I don't understand.
But you know, in the state of Illinois, the Dems, I'm sure in other states have done the same thing. They've ran on this pro-death platform, this pro-abortion platform, which, you know, they've highlighted the pro-life candidate and say, he's too extreme for our values. Too extreme for your values. I think those values are pretty extreme. So we'll see how it shakes out. It also brings up an interesting point here, and my next guest is going to address this. Early voting, for example, I was talking about John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, right? Dr. Oz, they had the debate. A lot of people said, oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't know if John Fetterman's capable of doing this. Well, 1 million votes have already been cast, right? States that allow early voting, they're seeing those ballots coming in large numbers right now. There was a report, I think it was Yahoo News, that said that more than 1 million Georgians cast their ballots in this year midterm elections through 8 days of early voting in the state. That smashed all records, previous records, you know, 8 day totals in 2018 by more than 50%. So after the state passed a law on voting procedures that its opponents would claim would make it more difficult to vote, right? And they thought, oh, this is horrible. They thought it would be discriminatory against blacks and other minorities. They shattered this record, right? So in this early voting is kind of a recent innovation. I don't know what state you're in, whether or not you can vote like that. Right now, there are only 4 states that don't allow some kind of early voting. I think it's Connecticut, Alabama, and if I'm correct, it's Mississippi and New Hampshire. But every other state allows for it in one way or another. But there is, you know, there is a difference from absentee voting, which is done if you're not going to be able to cast your ballot on election day. So states are all trying all kinds of ways to increase voter participation, and some of those ways are better than others. Here to give us some perspective on this is Zach Smith. He's legal fellow in the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Hey, it's great to have you with me today. Thanks so much for joining me, Zach.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on, Drew. I really appreciate the invitation.
No, it's a delight. I'm curious about early voting. A lot of states have it right now. Maybe, give me your take on it. I'm assuming there are a lot of merits to it. I also think there's some drawbacks to it as well, but give me your sense of early voting. Are we better off having a smaller window for it? Is it better off going election day? I mean, how do you view it?
Right. Well, look, I think the gold standard in terms of voting is in-person election day voting. Yeah, that is the gold standard for a lot of reasons. Now, in-person voting, even if it's early voting, tends to be more secure than absentee ballots. And so in that sense, you know, early voting in some ways is better than absentee voting. But I agree. I mean, you've highlighted a lot of problems with early voting. Voters often cast their ballots so early in the cycle that a lot of information has yet to come out. And we've seen this become an increasing problem as states have expanded their window from, you know, a week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks, you know, and so on until it's, you know, a month or more in some states and localities at this point. And so it's certainly a problem. But what's really a problem, what I think a lot of states unfortunately have not done a good enough job of getting a handle on yet, is the absentee balloting. Because not only do you have some of the problems associated with early voting, where voters are casting their ballots, you know, very early in the process, early in the cycle, but it's also an inherently less secure form of casting a ballot. Yeah. And so if there's going to be a problem in this upcoming election cycle or in 2024, I suspect we may see a lot of that focused around absentee balloting and the procedures and mechanisms in place to deal with that.
So do you think fraud increases with early voting, or is it just as safe and secure?
Well, look, in-person voting is obviously, again, much more secure than absentee balloting, whether it's on election day or whether you vote early.
Right.
But a lot of the fraud, you know, prevention mechanisms, yeah, are going to require other safeguards to be in place too. Things like requiring a voter ID when you show, yeah, up to the polls, things like requiring a signature match, things like having accurate and up-to-date voter registration laws. All of those, yeah, are going to make sure that the election process is safe and secure. And I'll put a quick plug in here, Drew. You know, uh-huh, one of the things we at Heritage have been working on for really the past year and a half and longer, but the last year, we spent most of the year compiling an election integrity scorecard. We have 12 broad categories with a number of individual questions under each of those categories. And we said, you know, if a state is doing everything perfectly, if they have, or, you know, the gold standard, they'll get 100 points out of 100. Now, you'll be shocked. No state got 100 points across every category. But, you know, there's certainly some states that are doing significantly worse than others. And so if you or your listeners are interested, I encourage you to go to heritage.org /election scorecard, and you can check out how your state ranks, see where it all short, see where it can improve, and see how it compares to every other state in the country.
I love it. All right, heritage.org, easy way to find that. My guest today, if you're just joining me, is Zach Smith, and we'll take your calls too at 888-914-9149. We were having a conversation before we went on the air, and one of my producers said to me, he said, do you think there'd be less early voting if election day was, let's help, instead of a Tuesday, on a Saturday, instead of, you know, making this a work week? And they also said, why didn't states just stick to absentee ballots like they've been doing rather than doing this early voting thing?
Well, I think, you know, like we were just talking about, the absentee balloting process is inherently less secure. You know, there needs to be a number of safeguards in place. And we all, you know, at Heritage, we also maintain an election fraud database with proven instances of election fraud. And if you go look at the election fraud database, a number of those instances come from absentee ballot fraud. You know, we've heard a lot about the vote trafficking, you know, the casting ballots for deceased individuals using absentee ballots. You know, all of this type of fraud that occurs is just inherently much easier to do that with absentee ballots. Now, in terms of whether to make it election day on a Saturday or a Sunday instead of a Tuesday, it's a possibility. But, you know, many locales now are, even on election day, making it very easy to vote, keeping polls open, you know, before working hours, late into the evening, after working hours. And so, you know, we are encouraging states to make it as easy to vote as possible while having appropriate safeguards in place to make sure that the election is safe, secure, and that we all can have confidence in the results and the outcome of the election.
So, final thoughts on this. What's the solution? I mean, can this all be fixed? Are there ways to allow earlier mail-in balloting to make sure it's easy to vote, but hard to cheat, or a way to get more people out? You know, I've always thought, you know, in terms of convenience, it'd be great one day. I don't know how they'll do this. If you can vote right off your computer, or vote right off your cell phone, some sort of encrypted double, and you know, who knows? Some way to ensure that it's you and only you, and it can't be hacked somehow. It would be great. I think the votes would go way through the roof. But give me your take on that. What the future of voting might look like, and if there's a way that we can somehow ensure greater safety and greater turnout.
Well, I think in a pie-in-the-sky world, that would be a great idea. But we're not there yet, unfortunately. And I think using, you know, the internet or your cell phone to vote, there are some technological limitations that we are not yet able to overcome to make sure that it's safe and secure. And in fact, one of the best practices we recommend is for the actual vote tabulation machines not to be connected to the internet, just
right.
to avoid any potential, mess ups or hacking incidents. But, you know, you ask about absentee balloting. I think it is inherently less secure than in-person voting, but there are safeguards when they allow absentee voting that they need to put in place. They should think about making sure that the absentee ballot is either notarized or witnessed. So there's someone swearing that, you know, that is the person signing the ballot, actually casting their vote. You need to limit the number of ballots that one person can witness, maintain a signature comparison requirement, maintain some type of identification requirement, whether it's a driver's license number or a social security number or a voter ID number. Be sure that the ballots stay in their envelope. Don't allow a permanent absentee ballot list like so many states have done previously. And again, there's a whole list of safeguards, common sense safeguards that states can put in place. And if you go to that heritage.org/election scorecard page, you can see all of our recommendations for what those safeguards should be, and more importantly, how states should implement those safeguards going forward.
Hey, thank you, Zach. Appreciate you being here. Zach Smith is the legal fellow in the Meese Center for Legal Studies, or Legal and Judicial Studies, at the Heritage Foundation. Go check out that website and make sure you go and vote. It's a patriotic thing to do.